This podcast is brought to you by the new term at fxphd.com. Hand in hand with FX Guide, our training site, FXPhd, allows you to do online training with the benefit of industry professionals to guide you. This new April term includes training in Nuke 7, Hero, editing, grading, lens tech, and even maths for VFX. Check it all out at fxphd.com. Hi, and welcome to the Man of Steel VFX Show, episode number 170. I'm Mike Seymour, and joining me here in the Fortress of Solitude is Matt Wallen. How are you, Matt?
I'm great. Did you say episode 170?
Yes, sir.
Wow. All right. I'm doing good. Ready to talk Superman.
And sitting with his underpants on the outside of his trousers, we have joining us also Jason Diamond. How are you, sir?
Great. It's great to be together in solitude.
So, guys, we're going to discuss the visual effects as we do. I wanted to start by seeing what you thought of the film. A bit tongue-tied today. I'm kind of surprised at how polarized the views have been on this film. Kind of stunned, actually. So I have no idea what you guys thought. But, Jason, starting with you, what did you think?
I saw it this morning, and I thought it was awesome. I have my things with Christopher Nolan's exposition. I felt like was really well mitigated in this film for the most part. I liked all the aspects, excuse me, of dealing with Superman as an alien, as he is for real, regardless of the style of Superman movie. He is and has always been an alien, and to deal with that on top of him being a superhero or superpowers. I thought it was handled really well. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Matt, what did you think?
Yeah, I will concur with Jason on his comment about sort of the exploration of Kal-El or Superman as an alien. I thought that was really, it was a fresh take for the film to really go heavily into the sort of alien componentry. I thought most of the script was really well written. There were a couple heavy-handed moments of dialogue here and there. There were some really spectacular visual effects. There were some really not-so-spectacular visual effects. There were some great moments in the film, and there were some moments that I thought, for me, I really want to have in a Superman film that were missing. But that being said, all in all, as a summer blockbuster tentpole style film, I mean, I had a great time. It was a really fun ride, but I'm not without my reservations. I did have a few problems with the film.
Well, let me ask you this. If you had to rate it versus the last reboot, which was the Pretty Boy version, versus the original Christopher Reeves version, and we'll just stop there because I don't think going back to the TV show is kind of so relevant, how would you rate this one?
I'd say the first two Richard Donner films with Christopher Reeve, maybe because I saw them, I think the first one came out when I was like 10 or something like that, or 9. And I was the perfect age for that movie. And I do have just such a like warm memory of Christopher Reeve in that role. And those first two films they're still so much fun to watch. I mean, they're kind of cheesy and hokey in ways now, but they still really resonate, and they're so human. There's such a human element. The who's the director of the Bryan Singer? Yes, the Bryan Singer version, has a couple great set pieces in it, but like it really didn't do anything for me. And this film, I think follows very closely. I would say it's the second best in my opinion. If we put Bryan Singer in third place, I'd put this one in the middle, behind the Richard Donner films. But maybe in some ways, out of a weird kind of nostalgia, I'm not really sure if I'm judging them through the lens of anything other than sort of my own personal history, which I guess is kind of all I've got to go on anyway.
I guess from my point of view, I've got a feeling that the Bryan Singer version is the Green Lantern version of the franchise. It was the kind of sort of everybody's pleasant and friendly and perky and stuff. I do think the Richard Donner versions, the villains were like pretty kind of not very I mean, the Lex Luthor was kind of so over the top and ridiculous. That being said, the other kind of slightly more witty humor of the Richard Donner films is what made me love them to death. So I didn't like the Lex Luthor kind of humor with the really sort of dumbass slapstick, but I definitely thought there was a lot more sort of, you know, you knew that Superman could do anything. So, you know, when he looked at Lois in the Richard Donner one and she's smoking and she's talking about, I'll get lung cancer, and he goes, not yet. Like, that was great. As a kid, I just thought that was just the funniest thing ever. It was such, you know, because they were playing with what I knew about Superman, and that was great. And I will say that I missed some of that from this version, in that I thought this version was could have had a touch more humor or a touch more sort of dry humor. I will say that I think if it had been anything less than fairly dark or at least brooding, it would have been a failure, because on the back of the Bryan Singer one, it just had to go the other way. But I think I cut you off, Jason. You were going to say something?
Oh, I was going to say, well, I was going to say that the reason that Donner, at least the first one, makes it to number one for me is Valerie Perrine as Miss Tessmacher, but maybe that was just my 10-year-old self. But, and Gene Hackman, I mean, you know, come on. But, you know, Zack Snyder, David Goyer, and the Nolans are not exactly known for their humor.
No.
So I think, like you said, you know, just go dark and live there.
I also have no problem with changing the suit and not having the underpants on the outside kind of stuff.
I don't care about that.
Because a lot of that stuff is just somebody made a decision on an aesthetic back in the day, and, you know, you can't get too ground up about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I actually thought the film was really, really good. I liked it a lot. I do think that I preferred the first half or the first two-thirds to the end, and I tend to be that way a bit with these kind of films because and I guess for me it was just an absolute cross between Avengers and Dark Knight. I mean, it's like you lose some of the humor, but you gain a lot of the kind of sort of strength of scene structure. I do want to discuss something before we get into visual effects, though, because I made a comment on Twitter that people have jumped on and told me that I'm a raving lunatic over. I really like the camera work in this. I thought that one of the things that gave this a lot of emotional punch and stopped some of the sort of flashback sequences from just being those sort of boring, can we get back to the story now, please? You know, we know that he grew up. Yeah, come on, we got it. Is that the camera work just seemed really evocative. Jason, what do you think? Didn't like it or didn't like it?
No, I did like it. I thought that in the close-ups, it might have been a little too handheldy, shaky at times. But the general look, I mean, I'm a sucker for anamorphic, especially with film. And I thought it looked fantastic. And it wasn't overly flary. You know, I don't think there was actually that many flares, given the amount of explosions and things that were going on. I said to my friend, my brother went with me this morning, but also my other friend, another Josh, and I turned to him at one point and I said, I feel like this is like the kind of movie Michael Bay wants to make, but he just doesn't have the ability to get there dramatically, because there's a lot of shots that reminded me of like an Armageddon or whatever, like the sort of medium close up of the truck. Little truck turned over in the yard, and the kid running through, it has that sort of commercial vibe to it that Michael Bay has, but with a lot more purpose.
Yeah. I mean, there was some real halation and stuff happening in some of those sequences, but it didn't feel like it was just rock video, Audi commercial kind, or maybe Audi's by example, but you just didn't have that kind of, you know, super artificial thing, and it had therefore a recollection feel about it, which gave it, I think, emotional validity. So I thought that the cinematography there was really, really strong.
And Matt, like a little Malick-y, you know?
Yeah,
like
absolutely,
touch of Malick, exactly.
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, I don't want to see cinematography reduced to we never notice it because it's such a transparent thing. I mean, let it be a bit creative and do some heavy lifting emotionally. And I thought that was really good. And Matt, I was going to say, this comment that I made got criticized, I think, a lot over people's attitude towards that same cinematography style extended into the digital effect shots.
So if we start on Krypton, where we had the initial war slash escape sequence, the camera work there was, again, quite distinctive. In fact, I would say probably more distinctive on an alien planet than we've seen in ages. It had tons of, like, Apocalypse Now and stuff in it for me. Matt, what did you think of the digital cinematography?
I mean, I really like almost all the material on Krypton, with a couple exceptions, but I thought that most of it was really strong, and it was so interesting to see that world articulated, and some of the technology that was explored in that world I thought was really fun to see, like the weird little floating, I don't know what those things were, the robots. Particle effect kind of thing. And but I just quickly to go back for 1 second to what you were talking about earlier with the overall camera work in the film, I will say that I saw this film non-IMAX, although I could have seen it IMAX or IMAX 3D or regular 3D or just plain vanilla, regular 2D screening. And I went for the regular plain vanilla 2D screening just to let it just be about the movie and the effects and the story. And I sort of avoided all the kind of extra elements that I could have added to my viewing. And I just wanted to say about the cinematography, I think that's really interesting for you two guys, having done a lot of shooting of your own on a host of projects. But I will say that the cinematography didn't bother me, except in a couple key moments where I thought it really didn't work, in terms of the sort of cinema verite, kind of documentary-esque style. And one part in particular where I actually found it just actually kind of disconcerting and jarring and visually difficult to watch, and I thought it disrupted the emotion of the scene, was the one where the young Clark Kent is sitting on the back of the pickup truck talking to his adopted father, right, the Kevin Costner character, and he's sitting on the back of the pickup, and they're talking about the bus accident. He says, "What did you want me to do? Did you want me to let him die, or was I supposed to let him die?" And he says, "Maybe." And that scene is such a powerful emotional moment, and I thought that was a place where, for me, the cinema verite kind of style of cinematography, I thought it called attention to itself in a way that was, for me, kind of inappropriate. It took me out of, I thought, the heavy emotional impact of that moment and drew attention to itself in a way that I didn't think was warranted. And so I thought there were times where, for me, it felt like it went too far. I didn't have that feeling in some of the wider shots, and certainly in some of the action sequences it was fine. But in those really close emotional moments, it didn't work for me, and it was actually really distracting. It was something that really actually bothered me and took me out of the film.
Yeah, I felt like the close-ups in general were overly shaky. Maybe they could have, I don't know what they were doing, but I agree. That scene particularly didn't bother me, but I agree that the close-ups or closer shots felt a little shaky. And I saw this regular plain 2D because I don't. Yeah,
there were just moments where I felt like the camera operator had like Parkinson's disease almost. It was so extreme, where it actually felt like it was style for style's sake, and it felt unmotivated by the story elements and the scripted elements that were taking place emotionally on screen. There were moments where it was appropriate, but some of them, they kept that same visual stylistic going on, and I felt like it distracted from the story, which I think is actually not the intent. I think that was, for me, that took me out of it, and I thought that was a bad choice.
I do think that Kevin Costner acted his ass off in this, and while I expected to enjoy, a lot of the stuff in the film, I actually thought that Russell Crowe had a kind of a in-control performance, which I was not anticipating. And Kevin Costner just, I think, hopefully this will get him another really mega strong dramatic role, because he just was a presence on screen for me in those scenes.
He's always been a great actor. He's just made some crappy movies, but he's always been good, Costner.
Yeah.
I've always liked him.
Yeah, I agree.
So, but I wanted to discuss, though, that style. Let's go back to Krypton and that opening sequence, because a lot of it's digital, and it is very distinctive cinematography in one sense. I mean, the Apocalypse Now one I'm referring to, there's like a kind of a sun. I assume it's a sun.
Oh, that was amazing.
And I love that. The alien ships are kind of coming at you like a Ride of the Valkyries, Apocalypse Now helicopter gunship kind of thing. And I don't know. It just was like, well, I just didn't expect that kind of a look. It's like someone was really fishing through my visual dictionary for coming up with references that, you know, that heat hazy kind of look and stuff. Mm-hmm. Just you don't expect that on an alien planet.
ILM did the same thing in Rango, and they got the same response. Yeah. When you just, if you can pull that off, which in both films they did, it's you mm-hmm. can't beat that shot. I mean, that's the shot, right?
I would agree, and a lot of that Krypton stuff too. Like, I thought it was, you know, it was visually bold, it was audacious. Like, they really went for something that had a very unique and kind of specific look. It kind of had a real sepia tone kind of thing going on throughout that whole world and all the sequences that took place in that Kryptonian space. And I thought that was really something. And I there were only a couple of shots, and I was wondering actually if either of you had seen it in 3D, because there were only a couple.
I saw it in 3D.
You did?
Yeah.
Because there were a couple shots where they showed, just to talk a little bit about some of the effects issues that relate to the Krypton sequence in particular, there were a couple shots of Russell Crowe riding on the back of that, you know, Valkyrie thing or whatever it is he's riding on, where it was very... you know, studio kind of A over B kind of comp. And it was even ones where it looked like it was him in front of like a blue screen or green screen. And the comps looked so tough, like the edges weren't so hot. And the, there was nothing really to delineate it. It looked like a bad, window comp in a shot within a vehicle or something, you know. And there were a few of those when he was flying that I thought were a little tough, and then there's some other ones we can get into, but I did think that overall the sequence and the lighting, the stylistic kind of color palette that was utilized in Krypton overall was pretty strong.
The three things that were strongest for me in that sequence were the digital cinematography that I've already touched on, the tech of Krypton, which was the liquid geo kind of pin
thing. Yeah, that was cool.
And then the third thing is I really liked the phaser, laser weapon things because, you know, they played pretty quickly, but then they had this plasma trail evaporating sort of residue, which I thought made them work well dramatically on screen. Because if someone shot really suddenly or you didn't see where it was coming from, you kind of got a post-shot sound effect thing that let you kind of see what was going on and understand the relationship. So that... I thought worked well, and I liked the look of those lasers kind of dissipating away.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always a big fan of the CG camera zoom.
Yeah,
like when it's used well, which they use it a lot in this. I love that because it just pulls you. To me, some people might say it pulls you out of it. To me, it puts me more in because it removes the CG floating camera possibility and turns it into a camera move. And, you know, granted it may be flying in the hovering in the sky, but you know, we're tracking Superman. So I, you know, maybe not be that such a big deal or we're on Krypton. So whatever, but they did that a bunch in the Krypton sequences. And I appreciated that Krypton was so long too. Like, it wasn't such a... I mean, it's pretty long in the first Donner film, too, but it was like half the first act, almost. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
It's really, really long. They showed you a lot of stuff that you saw later in the ships and the other sequences that we'll talk about. But I did like the sort of monochromatic liquid metal vibe of all the tech, and it wasn't this crazy HUD, you know, like Uber, you know, UI fest for all their tech. It was very simple and understandable.
Well, that was an interesting stylistic choice, I thought, too, in terms of the design of the whole world of Krypton in this film. If you go back and look at the Donner films, there's something almost, you know, it's very abstract. And, of course, you know, part of it, I'm sure, was budgetary constraints as well. But you go back and look at the first film with the sort of the ice kind of elements of it, and almost like columnar basalt or something, right, where it's these big ice fortress kind of vibe. And it feels almost like they have a more, and maybe part of it's Brando too, and Terrence Stamp or something, but there's this almost kind of godlike aspect to what they're doing, and the tech is so abstracted. It's very, you know, it's crystals and weird crap like that. And I think in this film, they went for something that felt much more grounded. It was more like a, you know, they were like knights in armor or something like that. You know, they had that kind of almost like a chainmail kind of texture on their clothing. And then they had this kind of, there was some sort of an order, and a real kind of grounded technology where they felt more human. They didn't seem quite as, I mean, not, you know, human, but they didn't seem quite as godlike maybe as they did in the Donner films.
I mean, there was kind of a slightly confusing plot point in that Jor-El is there telling the council that the planet is basically going to explode, right? Like, we're fucked. Planet's going to explode. And they're all like, well, what should we have done differently? Which means they're admitting that they know the planet's going to explode. And the first thing they do is hold a trial and put one of their people in the negative zone or phantom zone when they could have just left them on the planet to explode with everybody else. You know what I mean? Or maybe that was just me.
I think it's an excusable piece of plot because, you know, they might be it die. I mean, it might be that the planet's going to die, you know, sometime in the next generation rather than, oh, it's going to happen this quickly.
In 10 minutes.
Yeah, that wasn't such a plot kind of thing that it bugged the bajillikins out of me. Though
it wasn't like a crazy thing. I just was like, wait, that happened really fast. Although well, I did you're find right. they it didn't... really...
Oh, sorry, I was just going to say they didn't make the same point that they made in the Donner film, which was that, like, in the Donner film, it's that Jor-El is almost, he's like a heretic or something, right? Like, nobody, he's like, the end is near, right? And they're all kind of like, dude, you're chill out, man. It's cool. Everything's good. And in this film, they didn't really have any, there was no real resistance to Jor-El's explanation of sort of that they depleted the planet's resources or whatever. And they just kind of, they were like, yeah, whatever. Okay. Like they didn't seem to have any sense of urgency on the part of the, whatever that was, the council or whoever those people.
Do you think that, do you think that Zack Snyder had already had a camera department section called the Phantom Zone? Sorry, bad cinematography joke.
yuck.
The tech on the liquid metal or the liquid geo is something that I got to sit down and talk to the Weta team about because I was over in New Zealand for a while. And it's pretty interesting how they did it. I'm going to write a story on an FX guide about it. But the liquid metal is basically a fluid sim, and it's done with variable-sized metal pieces that the gravity of which is defined to be towards the actor. So if you were to think of gravity normally going straight down towards their feet, it's coming towards, say, their face. And there's a thresholding system they've got in place. So you sort of get a certain amount of turbulent stuff going on. And then if you have enough of an attractor from the base, it breaks free of the back and falls to the front, thus filling the front. And then they have a field that defines the geometry of whatever you want at the front. So what you basically do is pour metal particles from the back of the display to the front of the display, and I'm now coming towards the actor that's watching it. And if that happens to be a picture of Earth, then they, you know, it's a bit like if you're pouring sand into a glass bowl that was the shape of Earth and you were looking underneath it, looking up at it, that's what you'd kind of see. And it took, took the Weta guys a while to get that sussed out and then to continue with it to be able to avoid it just chattering like crazy with noise and doing a bunch of other things. And then from there, there is a second kind of version, which is the history of Krypton section where, you know, you see it's like a kind of a relief thing. You know, it's like a,
yeah,
as if like a Roman or a whatever wall relief. And that in itself had its own geometric interest, I think, because that was played out in physical space in the sense that you would be like a meter deep if you were standing on set and this thing was really happening for real. Though all the models that were in it were sometimes just models from what was happening outside with the high-res spaceship. So you take that high-res model and say, I need to stick it now in my liquid geo thing. Though it was more of a animation than a simulation once it was doing the diorama thing because they weren't actually forming up in front of your eyes. And then they'd have to sort of take all that huge depth of a real ship and a real planet and then project it down to this relief version that has everything effectively flattened out. So if you think about that for a second, if I had a box or a car, is a good example, we all know what a car looks like. So I would want the car, if I was looking on the front three-quarter of it, to not be anymore a rectangle. I want it to actually be a kind of a squished, flattened rectangle. Still looks right in perspective, but in fact, it's a sort of a diagrammatical cheat so that it doesn't have as much depth as a car should really have. And the other thing that you want it to do is be able to read it. And of course, it's an interesting problem. I mean, we were joking about this, that, you know, in the future, they only have black and white TVs, but you want it to be able to read yeah. this thing. So it's all about getting the light to work on it properly. And I actually got to sit down with Joe Letteri, who's just, I think, one of the most interesting people in the entire visual effects industry. But he was just saying, like, it's just a matter of light. Think about it. Like, you've got basically gray stuff on a set. To make that interesting, you have to have really good, clear lines of animation. But you only read it because of the light. So they're actually inheriting some of the lighting from the non-flattened world and then transposing that onto the flattened world so you can read the effective curvature, so that an Earth doesn't look like it looks like a frisbee. It still looks like Earth, still has the shading of Earth, even though it is in fact the shape of a frisbee. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And I just,
yeah, and I think
go on.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to say I think that the that effect, you know, with just anecdotally too, Joe Letteri, by the way, is such an awesome guy. I hadn't seen him in probably over 10 years when I went to Weta for the last bit of King Kong. And I, you know, wouldn't have imagined that he would ever remember who I was. And he's got like a near photographic memory. Like the second he saw me, he's like, "Matt Wallen, how's it going?" Like he knows, he remembers everything. The guy's amazing. But
he is
awesome. Yeah, and he's an awesome supervisor. Just such a nice guy. I mean, he's just great. I mean, you know, he's one of those people that, you know, I just am always so excited to see him get the accolades that he gets, because I think it's just so, he's so worthy of it, you know, he's so deserving of it.
Now, I should point out, Joe is, for those that don't know, the head, effectively, of Weta, but not the visual effects supervisor of this film, just to put it in context, we speak. So he is the driving force, as it were, of Weta, and thus oversees all these films, but he wasn't the specific visual effects supervisor on the film. But sorry, go on.
I was just going to say that fluid effect within the context of the sort of those floating sort of, you know, communication devices, I thought, you know, was just, it looked so cool. It was such an interesting look, and they really achieved something, I think, that was, it felt new, it felt fresh. It was a new kind of, but yet weird, otherworldly kind of tech. It almost looked like when they had the full face of Jor-El's wife, I can't remember her name, but the Superman's mother, in there, where she was like, "Look out behind you," or whatever. I mean, it almost looked like the kind of thing that you'd see, like, on a, I don't know if you guys have ever played around with, like, the Microsoft Kinect or whatever. You know, it was this weird, low-res, like, low-fidelity kind of look, but it looked like a believable kind of thing as well. Like, it had a really nice aesthetic to it. I did find, though, that the, and this is maybe just a personal taste thing, but I thought the design aesthetic and the vibe of the kind of narrative components of the sort of history of Krypton, I found it kind of, it sort of suspended disbelief a little bit beyond what I had already seen previously, and that, you know, certain elements of it almost took on a kind of like Soviet era artwork and stuff, and it felt so sort of earthly and overly art directed.
I thought that was great. The Stalinesque,
oh, you like that?
This Zod Stalinesque march thing. God, that was one of my favorite aspects. Yeah.
Really? Yeah. I don't know. I just felt like that was, it felt so foreign to the, because it became something that was almost illustrative. It was like, it was art, but it was Earth art. You know, it didn't feel like it was sort of Kryptonian art or something. Like, it took on a different vibe that, I don't know, for me it just didn't click.
I actually really liked that sequence. I enjoyed the sort of maybe more earthly tone to it. I like the look of it. I think my only criticism of it is that it pieces of it move by so fast that there's probably tons of visual information that you could have gotten if they slowed it down by like 25%. Maybe this didn't work in the pacing of the edit or the way that, you know, Russell Crowe's delivery was, but I thought I really liked it. And I did like the Stalin-y, that sort of Soviet vibe of it. That's or whatever the maybe more Roman or Greek, you know, Olympian type vibe. Mm-hmm. But
it said an enormous amount.
It felt like coins to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kind of like,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What was interesting about it is when the thing settles and you go for the close-ups, they could orientate all the particles, which were actually kind of more like a round pyramid cone kind of shape. They could orientate those with all the flat ends to the outside, and then they just scaled them slightly. And if you get all these things and just scale them just slightly, it fills in all the tiny little gaps between them, and it becomes the solid, you know, key that is the Superman key that becomes a plot point. I thought it was just a really ingenious, good, healthy new tech that didn't just say, "Oh, it's so clever, I wave my hand and it all just suddenly happens." I thought it was great. But I got to say that there's lots of aspects of the production design that I also liked. I mean, you mentioned earlier those suits and having that kind of very much sort of, I don't know, medieval sort of wearing various coats of arms and things. I like all that stuff. I think it does communicate pretty effectively to an audience a lot about a story. I mean, I know the Stalinist thing took you out of it, but it sort of said a lot about that character. The emblematic nature of the sort of uniforms and stuff said a lot about them, and you sort of suddenly tie into a whole mythology and you kind of get it really quickly, so you don't have to have a lot of background and expositions. I think that stuff is pretty good, especially in your alien world. If you go to
It was a great visual device for the exposition that was required for the audience to be able to kind of continue and follow with the rest of the narrative. And I do agree with you. I do think that the coat of arms kind of, that was something that you also, there was that element as well in the Donner films too, where all the different guys on the council had different sort of weird emblems and coats of arms. So that was something that I think, you know, was sort of contiguous between the two films. But yeah, no, I mean, I think there were certainly some great elements, I think it's just a total, you know, personal taste thing. Like that, the scenic part, just the artwork of it took me out of it a little bit. I don't know, but you know, I'm willing to let the bygone. It wasn't a big deal.
Well, I think it was Zack Snyder who said that the actual quote unquote Superman costume is actually an it's what they wear under their armor, and he's technically unshielded on Earth, which is, I guess, is subliminal. But from a art costume design standpoint, I loved the Zod returning to Earth fighter helmet costumes design, the black fighter helmets or whatever they wore when they finally landed on Earth.
That became transparent?
That became transparent.
Oh, I love those too. And I love that there was actual stuff to do with atmosphere.
Yeah, but
yeah, didn't you think those helmets were almost like the helmets from
Never Say Die?
It
was Never Say Die Black Sabbath album cover.
Okay,
full on. Look it up.
But it was like also logical in the sense that if you had something that was going to be a helmet, that you'd want a large degree of peripheral vision. Like, you know, I have a problem when people wear helmets, especially underwater, that then have lights in them shining in your eyes so you couldn't possibly see anything. Yeah. It's like the worst helmet in the world. If you can have dark, like, evil helmets. Yeah, but then, you know, you don't just have a little tiny thing to peek out of. I mean, you know, surely the easiest way to kill Batman is to walk up behind him. He can't even turn his head, you know. Like, I thought it was just really, yeah, I totally agree. I do want to just, before we leave, flag that Weta did that stuff at and Krypton. So that was kind of, there was a number of companies that contributed, but Weta was pretty much the company that did that. And I think it looked like you'd expect from one of the great companies in the world. And also, I do want to also pick up on your point about the way Weta is today. One of the great shames of the industry is we spend a lot of time talking about how, you know, people are kind of hand to mouth and it's really desperate and times are bad. And I'm not suggesting for a second that ILM or Weta or some of the other companies that we don't normally include in that conversation are just rolling in cash, far from it. But what I do get from Weta is a sense, and I get it from some other companies as well, but I really got it from Weta, is they have a multi-film R&D plan. Like, they put into effect stuff for, I don't know, tissue or deep compositing or, you know, sort of new improved subsurface scattering. They'll put that stuff in knowing that they're going to use it on this film and a few more down the pipe. Like, they build up their their set of tools. And as a consequence, they've got this super strong R&D base. You know, in some companies, you sort of hear about them doing stuff and it's really tight and money's really tight. And you get a feeling that they're just sort of hiring freelancers and getting the work done. And it's great when you go to one of these other companies where you just have a sense of, okay, we have a plan and it's a multi-year plan and we're enacting it. And yeah, okay, budgets are tight, but they're not just doing whatever they can to get the film out the door and they're like in a mad scramble and nobody knows what they're doing. It's like a really well thought out organization. And we spend obviously a sensible amount of time feeling bad about those companies that are in the other position, but we shouldn't fail to acknowledge when companies just seem, you know, really well run. We got to Earth now in the story, and we have this obviously flashback thing, but let's assume for a second there are no flashbacks, just for making life simple for a second. There are two big battle sequences on Earth. There's the first kind of one, and then there's the final, hey, we're going to destroy the city, Metropolis, insurance companies, watch out.
Superman creates jobs, man.
Yeah, exactly. Along the way, there are some other small sequences, but we're probably not going to go into a lot of detail, like the bus going over into the water and stuff. What do we think about that first battle, the battle of throwing trains around? Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely enjoyed it. I thought it was, you know, pretty visceral. It was exciting. I loved seeing the way in which they introduced Superman to the people of Earth or whatever, where he's sort of hovering, you know, maybe 30 feet off the ground or something in front of a small, you know, platoon or a battalion of tanks and, you know, military helicopters and stuff. I thought that moment was really exciting, and how he chose to it, narratively as well. I mean, how he sort of chooses to, you know, relinquish him or relinquish his power, right, and sort of lets them handcuff him or whatever. And he explains that later, you know, if it makes them feel safe. And I thought that was a really neat moment where, you know, he's sort of being put in this position where he has to make that kind of and execute that kind of decision making. And then when the battle itself actually begins and starts in sort of, I guess main street of Smallville or whatever it is. I mean, I thought it was really fun. It reminded me a lot of, but I think it was better executed, but it reminded me a lot of the battle sequence in that kind of, I think I referred to it as like Radiator Springs in the first Thor film.
Yeah.
Oh, right? God.
Where it was clear that they had built that town, and this one felt a little bit more believable as like an actual sort of main street. And I thought it was kind of neat too, given that they wove it in with the flashback sequences, where it's sort of like, you know, he's having the opportunity as an adult to come back to the town in which he grew up and sort of be demonstrative of his abilities in a way that he wasn't when he was young, where he sort of repressed and suppressed his uniqueness as a child. And then here as an adult, he sort of, it's almost like he's, you know, he's like coming out of the closet or something, you know, it's like, you know, Superman, and he's sort of doing his thing. And I thought, you know, the way they did it was great. There was some, the only thing about it I think that I didn't like, I thought the effects were really strong. I really enjoyed the spectacle of it, the kind of the immenseness of it. You know, I think having things like the locomotive engine and stuff, and some of the speed with which they moved, I thought was really fun to watch. And the asphalt being torn up as he's sort of, you know, pushing him across the street. But the product placement was so heavy-handed in some of this stuff. I don't know if you guys agree,
well,
but it was,
you don't
like,
have a, you don't was, have a $225 million budget without some product placement, unfortunately.
Not, man, it was
now are we talking about LexCorp product placement
No,
I mean like Sears and IHOP and 7-Eleven, and it was like, man, it was so extreme. You know, I mean, it's great that it's
set
in
the real... I didn't have that much of a problem with it, really, but...
Yeah, well...
I mean, it's there. It wasn't as bad as, like, Men in Black 2, you know what I mean? Like... It was there, necessarily need to be there. Could have been any, you know, restaurant queue, but it's, I mean, it didn't totally kill me. But I think when you said about the Thor thing, I think we all did the Thor movie VFX show together. And I think the thing that we had said was that during that fight sequence, seeing Thor and Loki and all those dudes in the city in that little town in the daytime just totally ruined right. everything because yeah, they yeah, looked yeah. like it looked like the Disney parade, you know?
Yeah.
And,
you know, Kiss Unmasked or something.
Yeah. and that you didn't have that feeling here. Like, it totally worked.
I'd agree. I think it felt much more like they were in the same world, and it was sort of, it felt pivotal too, because it was woven into a kind of, you know, a global realization of this kind of alien right. presence on Earth. So it took on a different kind of level of, like, global consequence. So it felt more kind of grounded or something.
I loved that they, multiple things, one of which I think is realized, or sort of both realized in that initial Smallville sequence, is when Zod's helmet gets cracked, or whatever the goop is that forms the helmet, and he experiences, you know, all the things that it took Superman his whole adolescence to learn how to deal with, the, you know, X-ray vision and hearing all the, you know, being super sensitive to light and sound and what have you. I thought that was really smart, because that's they're from the same planet, so they should have the exact same reaction. It's just Superman has trained himself to be able to deal with it. And I believe at that point was the first time they showed actual beams coming out of Superman's eyes. Because when he heals Lois in the ship, his eyes just get red, but you don't see beams, or at least I didn't recall seeing beams. And I turned to my brother and I said, that's interesting that they're playing the heat vision without beams. And it's not until he gets super pissed that the beams really fire out, as do Zod's later in the right before he gets his neck snap, when he's just like, you know, slicing everything in half with his super X-ray beam or heat vision beams. But I thought that was really smart, and I thought it was done really well. I really liked the X-ray vision stuff. It's sort of reminded me of They Live a little bit, in a good way. And but also the way the better name Allura, or whatever the Zod's female counterpart is, when she starts picking up speed and, like, really zipping between people as she's hitting them, I thought was really nice. It was like a real, like, they got certain powers under control really fast. You know,
I thought it was a particularly clever plot point, because at this point in the story, you have to say, well, there's Superman, there are the bad guys, he's outnumbered, they've got the same skills as him. How could you possibly get Superman to make them go away enough to get us to a third act? But when you have this thing that they can't work very well without their helmets on, and they kind of need to retreat to deal with that, it's a believable obstacle in their path that doesn't make it, aha, now you've discovered their complete weakness and you can, you know, get rid of them all. It's right. like, well, we're going to adjust to that. We just haven't adjusted yet, which bought us some time in the plot. Otherwise, it's completely unbelievable. You've got him. You know, you've outnumbered him. Let's just finishing him off now. So it was a good sort of believable plot point. And it's hard to have those, obviously, because sometimes you just like, well, why would you possibly just stop? I mean, what's the, you know, why would you right. go away?
Well, and they never actually, no one's ever actually, outside of using kryptonite, no one's actually, or at least, I'm not an avid reader of the comics, but in the films, at least, they've never actually said that Superman could be killed. You know what I mean? Like, outside of being weakened by kryptonite to where he becomes human, have human weaknesses and could be shot or whatever, as he is in Superman 2, I believe. So the fact that they're fighting for so long, at a certain point, I did feel like, okay, where's the threshold of someone needs to figure out how to beat these guys? Because clearly punching each other over and over and over again, it's not going to work.
It's not going to do it, yeah. No, I had that at the end as well. It's like,
yeah.
Really? You can break your neck? Okay, well, that would have been good to know. MPC did the Smallville fight sequence. They also did some various flying shots. Now, I don't know if they actually did it, but they did do Lois in space. So let's assume for a second that it's MPC. What did we think of the Messiah exit from the spaceship? Because there's lots of Jesus yeah. Savior overtones,
yeah,
and I don't want to get into a Catholic kind of religious thing.
No. But I will say, though, that, I mean, I think if you go back to the origins of the character of Superman, you know, he's an allegorical figure, you know, and I do think that there, I thought those elements were some of the more deftly handled elements, both directorially and in terms of the screenplay within the film. I thought that, you know, yes, that one exit from the spacecraft, I mean, it is pretty heavy-handed, but it's, you know, it's in keeping with some of the other elements that we saw within the film. Like, there's that sort of almost like dream sequence, or I don't know what that was, where he's like sinking into the skulls, and there's this kind of, you know, Holocaust kind of allegory going on there as well.
Yeah,
and I don't know. I kind of feel like that's one of the things about the character of Superman that I think, you know, remains sort of, you know, culturally and thematically relevant, is that it is a Christ story, right? And so I think that's one of the reasons why it resonates for a lot of people, and it kind of has these elements that that communicate and evoke certain kinds of emotions or certain kinds of senses of, you know, hope or whatever, or kind of a, you know, a mysticism or something. And so I think that those elements, for me, I thought they worked really well. It didn't bother me. I thought it was, they didn't do it so often that it was, you know, it got tired. I thought they did it just enough.
It wasn't the third
Matrix,
never
spoke to it. Yeah. And they never spoke to it, really. It was just sort of an element within the film. And I actually really enjoyed that part of it. I thought it gave it a certain gravitas that maybe it wouldn't have had without it for me.
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, I openly am religious, and I find that what was nice about it is that they had the foresight to have Clark visit a church without him necessarily saying, I'm going to do whatever the church says. But by the same token, just that single nod says, we're not denying the existence of religion on Earth, and we're not, I mean, I just think it was like, I don't want people to be overly preachy. I just want them to not be downright insulting. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I read an article with David Goyer, who said, I intentionally wrote him as a Moses-Jesus hybrid. I intentionally made him 33. I intentionally, his parents put him in a basket, basically, and send him to another place.
Send his only son to save Earth. Yeah, no, I'm with you.
Yeah, I mean, so, and I'm fine with that. And I'm not a religious person, although I have the background in it from how I was raised. But I thought it would bother me more, like looking at the trailers and stuff, which I was super pumped on the movie. I was hoping they wouldn't get super heavy-handed with it, and I don't think they did. I thought it was handled really well, and you could almost intimate that his exit from the ship was a intentional show of symbology to the humans, right? Because
But they weren't seeing that.
Right, because it was the – sorry, I got it wrong.
Yeah.
But Goyer said in the interview that knowing that Clark was raised in Kansas, it's most likely that he would have been raised, you know, Protestant or Methodist or some sort of Midwestern thing. So the fact that he would go to the church to talk to the priest, even though he's not specifically asking a religious question – and he tells the priest outright, I'm an alien, I thought it was an interesting thing that he would go somewhere where he would technically potentially feel comfortable.
I mean, the thing is, it would be very easy to – and look, there are lots of films that have, from the writing, religious overtones, like The Witch, The Wardrobe, and the whatever, you know, all that kind of – and the line in Narnia, but
C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, but in this particular case, it's also easy to, you could have had, you know, a ton of shots of people declaring that he was the Messiah on the streets with billboards when, you know, they came from outer space, you know, and portray a nutcase religious side group. Anyway, I just thought it was interesting, and certainly that there was a number of shots that, you know, were pretty obviously visual effects shots that were walking a line there in terms of, you know, halos of light and other things that were clearly giving it a certain divine overtone or tapping into imagery that we associate with religious iconography. Hey, so that gets us to our third act battle. And now we're no longer with MPC, who, by the way, have a wicked destruction pipeline. Like the stuff that they used for smashing those. Well, yeah, they just, it's got a finite element analysis pipe that's just awesome. But the Metropolis destruction sequence is now being handled, I believe, by DNEG, where, of course, quite a lot of things go wrong for the poor town of Metropolis.
Yeah.
So, okay, so let's take it in the two parts. There's the general kind of 9/11 stuff where there's buildings falling over and plumes of stuff coming towards people. And obviously, Jason, you've got a pretty good perspective on that. And then there's the second lot of stuff, which is the let's just fight a lot and knock out buildings punching each other with super punches. So do you want to comment first, Jason, on that whole kind of buildings coming down feeling in what was not New York, but God damn it, looked like it?
Yeah, I thought it was really well done. I mean, when they show is it the Daily Planet building? I can't remember, but whatever, the building that basically tips over on Larry Fishburne.
Yep.
Because I refuse to call him Lawrence Fishburne.
No, he's a good actor.
He's great. I love him, but I preferred him as Larry.
Okay.
Personally.
He was in Apocalypse Now, right?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
As a youngster.
The tender age of like 14 or 15.
Yeah, he lied, said he was 18 or whatever.
How cool is that?
But I thought that those sequences of the buildings being destroyed were the main buildings, not the as they were fighting, but where the fighter jet went through the building and chopped out the leg of it and that kind of stuff was really solid, because especially the one that was falling over on Larry Fishburne was very clear. It wasn't like a lot of times in these movies you see that, but they're occluded by so much particulates and other mm-hmm. things because there's other stuff going on. But in this, you could see like the reflection of the glass and the building so nice and clean. It was just like a building tipping over, you know, because there was no destruction higher up enough to cause pollution in the air. And
they did great stuff with that too, as it fell, where they had, not only did they have all the reflections in the windows, but the windows were, you know, set at just slightly different angles as well.
Yeah.
So it gave it a heightened sense of realism as it started to fall over, and the reflections were moving in slightly different directions based on those incident angles of the, you know, slight variant placement of the windows. That whole destruction sequence, I mean, it's just so top notch. I mean, they really achieved something visually that is just, you know, astounding. It's amazing how much destruction there is by the end of it, but I mean, they really did. I mean, I thought they knocked it out of the park in terms of the destruction and all the, you know, the particle sims and the cascading of bits of glass and concrete and what have you. I thought they really just did an amazing job.
I don't think they knocked it out of the park. I thought they were playing in the same park that I think ILM did on Transformers Dark Side of the Moon. I know it's called Dark of the Moon. Because I've got to say, the Chicago destruction sequence in that, with the building that got, I'm pretty sure it's the third one, right, where it falls on its mm-hmm. side and
yep,
like that, that to me is the definer of, you know, now it's not just a top each other kind of thing. Like, is it appropriate to the story and is it, you know, what you want to have at this point? But as great as that work was, it felt, you know, that they were batting and going toe-to-toe with the same level of stuff that we saw from what, 2 years ago in Dark Side of the Moon? Yeah?
Yeah. What would you suggest for doing it better, per se?
Well, I don't think it needed to be any different, but I just would have thought, I would have probably stayed away from that building. It's a very distinctive thing for a building to pivot and fall like that, you know, because we normally think of a building as coming down on top of itself. Mm-hmm. It sort of goes straight down, collapsing, rather than this full lever action that gets it going way out to the side. And as soon as I see that way out to the side, 20 stories of kind of hinged building, I go back to the Dark Side of the Moon, and that was just so well done. I mean, whatever criticisms you have of that film, it was just a spectacular piece of thing in its day, and it's almost like they own that sort of visual language.
I mean, I would agree with you in that sense, Mike. I mean, I do remember saying a couple times, I think, on this program that, like, I mean, I did feel like that Transformers 3 building destruction, I did feel like I was seeing something that was really new, that I had not seen before. But I think that, you know, thematically and stylistically as well, both in the context of the scene and in the larger film, the event in the Transformers film is, it's really the primary, you know, action that's taking place within the city at that moment. And I think there's so many buildings that get a pretty heavy hand of destruction in the Man of Steel movie that I don't know if they're really being played out in the same way as sort of key primary set pieces in the, so maybe there's so many more buildings being destroyed. It feels like, you know, it's in the same zone, but I don't know that it's receiving the same amount of direct focus. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could say, you know, Dean Egg managed to do in a secondary plot point what ILM was doing in a primary plot point.
Yeah.
But that being said, I'm not taking anything away from it. I think it was really, really good. It's just such a signature piece of that Dark Side of the Moon film. I mean, it just, that's the thing I go to when I think about that film, that I find it really hard to watch. I just, you know, as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, not that I've seen this before, because it was great. It was really well done. But it was just like, that's the, you know, it's like if you get guys walking up in black ties with sunglasses in slow motion in a line, it's the Reservoir Dogs shot. And, you know, you can't redo that shot without referencing Reservoir Dogs. Just they own it.
Yeah. They set a frightfully high bar for,
yeah,
you know, yeah.
Not that Dean Egg did anything wrong. It's just, I think, I'd have had the building come down different. I just wouldn't have gone there.
I mean, I think in Man of Steel, what Matt's point is, maybe you would think was the discussion they were having about, it's not the plot. I mean, the building is falling, yes, on them. And so it's a plot point that they need to escape a fucking building falling on them. But at the same time, I think the way the building is falling, outside of it just needing to fall towards them, is probably not that big of a plot point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean,
in terms
the thing
of needing
is,
to focus on how to change it, because if it is going to come straight down, then you lose that whole scene. So if they're really having to focus on keeping that scene, I would say probably the bigger deal out of that for me was the gravity impeller, the way that they didn't immediately tell you that they're sending their ship and the World Builder to either sides of the planet at Mach 24, and they're going to use basically a Tesla resonance principle to bounce, you know, gravity pulses back and forth through the planet, which you imagine would probably disrupt the core before it would make giant dust clouds to cause nuclear winter. But my only thing was, they didn't even show a tidal wave from either the gravity, the World Builder hitting the Indian Ocean, right, where the guy's fishing.
Yeah, the tsunami.
Yeah, no tsunami. Yeah. And when it was destroyed and fell over into the water, there was, again, no tsunami destroying all of, you know, Sumatra and Indonesia or what have you.
Okay, so, yeah, I mean, I can't argue with the physics. It felt like poor old planet Earth was getting a giant wedgie. But it was, okay, but it was, I think it was impressive, and it was also another good thing, you know, plot device-wise, like stick it on either side of the planet, so you'd have some reason for the humans to do something while Superman did something else. Otherwise, it'd just be like, oh, we're just going to sit this one out, whatever you want to do to fix this problem.
Yeah.
You know, come up with some reason why the humans had to drop this thing on top of it and Superman wouldn't do it. Well, the only thing you can do is, like, he has to be physically on the other side of the planet. So, you know, that was a good thing. But, yeah, I thought the destruction sequence was good. Don't get me wrong. I'm really not criticizing it for lack of but, you know, the same company had my jaw dropping when, well, I guess it was the same company. It was pretty much the same combined team of Nolan / Dean Egg when they flipped the tanker in Dark Knight, I mean, that wasn't a bigger thing. It was a much smaller thing. But, man, it had so much visual impact. And so I'm not saying that I have a better idea than that building falling towards them, except for I know that this giant creative team can produce stuff that has my jaw on the ground. So I wanted one of those because they're really good.
However, not to sink your ship a little, but they did take that truck flipping sequence from Night Watch, the Russian film.
The way the camera traveled in as that sucker flipped in the streets of Chicago in IMAX is to this day, I saw it again on Blu-ray the other night. One of my daughters had got to that age where she decided that she was old enough to see it against my best wishes. and between me trying to sort of grab the remote control to skip bits that were too scary, that truck flipping is...
No, it's phenomenal.
...sensationally good. My point is, though, that I didn't have... I don't know. Look, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say if Nolan had actually directed the Superman, that building would have been of truck flipping qualities. That was my oh God, I'm getting in trouble here. That's my thin line between Nolan directing and not directing.
That may have been true. However, they would have been talking about the building flipping for about 10 minutes before it flipped. So we can say, be glad we were saved from that section of the Nolan directing the film.
Hey, so then we get the big punch out, right? Like the fly around and just punch each other in the face. And notwithstanding, again, a lot more Luthor Corp product placement and, you know, this many days of injury-free kind of signage jokes. What do we think of the big punch-up, Matt?
I mean, you know, it was all right. I think I enjoy seeing what they did in terms of the way the sequence plays out. There's that bit where Superman is flying sort of over the tops of the buildings, and he's sort of, you know, right hook, left hook, right hook, left hook, and as he's flying forward and the camera's moving at a really high rate of speed. And I think, you know, it was kind of fun to see that because it was sort of visually, it was sort of different. It had a kind of flavor that was, I don't know, you're imagining Superman, and how would you do Superman in a big fight sequence, you know, with the technology that, you know, people have at their disposal today, as opposed to the sort of big sequence at the end of Superman 2 in the Richard Donner movie, and, you know, where they're kind of floating and sort of spinning and whatnot in a real kind of cable harnessed way. And so this felt more free form. And I mean, it was all right. I guess it, for me, it didn't feel like it topped anything that had come before it, though, in terms of the sort of punch out bit. I don't know that, you know, the sort of the climactic scene and then the kind of falling action in the third act, I don't know if it really came together for me personally in that respect as a film. The visual effects I thought were strong. There weren't things about it that, you know, I don't think worked. I loved when there were some great shots that I thought were really strong, like when the big you know, Trident ship or whatever first kind of comes and is sort of hovering over Manhattan, and you see it from a number of different people's points of view. Metropolis. Yeah, it was definitely not Manhattan, which actually would have been better if it was Manhattan. It felt like Vancouveropolis or something. But as the ship came floating in, I thought the compositing and lighting of that sequence I thought was really strong, with the sort of backlight and, you know, the sort of the distance cueing and whatnot that was happening, I thought was really great. I mean, there were so many really strong standout moments in the film. There was even one moment when towards the end, when he's Superman is flying upwards at one of the two things, I guess the one that's in the Indian Ocean or something, and he's flying up towards it, and he's in that kind of gravity well beam thing that's shooting down. And there was a moment where I swear to God, he looked exactly like Christopher Reeve.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like they stuck Christopher Reeve's face in there, and that just, I don't know, just the whole story of Christopher Reeve and his whole, you know, his post-Superman injury and then his sort of crusade for spinal cord injuries and stuff and his ultimate demise. I mean, that whole thing is, to me, it's just, there's something so moving about his story, and to see for a second, to see a glimpse of what I actually thought was, like, it looked like they inserted his face there for a second. And I thought that was so cool. And so there were so many great moments in that. But and I think the effects were really strong. There wasn't anything that really stood out to me as not working, but there were bits that I thought
the sequence is a little long. Didn't,
yeah, it felt long, and it didn't really. I don't know. It didn't have the payoff, I guess, that I was hoping for at the end. And I don't know if I personally could have thought of a different way to bring it to a conclusion either. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt, I guess.
Does anyone else wonder how Lois sort of always knows where Superman is? Like, they're destroying the whole city. They're flying at, like, incredulous speeds. And then she's like, oh, he's right over there in the Grand Central Station type building.
Yeah.
And she sort of waltzes in.
Yeah, well, but, there are. Yeah, why didn't everybody else in the world know about his mum? Because, yeah, you know, there was the whole thing about I grew up in Kansas. Like, how hard can it be to, yeah, you know?
Well, she found him in about 2 minutes.
Granted,
it was a montage, but still. But
we didn't discuss the initial ice ship stuff. You know, where the cast of the West Wing discovered the spaceship. And that, to me, was a bigger plot point because, for the life of me, I still don't understand why there was an unmanned ship conveniently sitting around there from 16,000 years ago, whatever it was. Somebody explain that to me? I literally do not understand.
That was actually described...
Go ahead,
Jason.
You guys are so keen to set me right. Okay, Jason, you start.
They said... Jor-El says that they, you know, they've been a... Up until they went wrong, Krypton was a flourishing civilization for 100,000 years of, like, golden age technology, and that they had sent, advanced teams to worlds for world building and surveying around the – and they didn't really say galaxy, just said space. But – and that they had found Earth. So – that ship had, and then they abandoned them, right? I don't know why they all would have necessarily died, but maybe on those planets, they show Zod coming across a couple of the places which is where he gets his ship and the world builder and what have you to somehow turn the Phantom Drive into a hyperdrive. I don't know if you just, you know, flip it backwards. I don't, you know, whatever. They're,
oh, yeah, no, they're interchangeable. It's the AA battery of Krypton.
People, yeah. but anyway, so they basically explained that they were explorers and that they had been there for that long.
So it's just convenient that a bunch of explorers happened to go to Earth 16,000 years ago, happened to, for no apparent reason, die and leave a ship that had the same tech as would be available 16,000 years later when Superman's father makes a key still works. Because, like, I got to tell you, I can't play a cassette tape anymore in my house. And I can barely play a CD. I can do it in the car. So the thought that after all those many gazillion years that you would have exactly the same key tech to make everything work and pop up and, I mean,
The Genesis chamber was the same. The Kryptonian caviar, as I was calling it.
So it was like, huh? Wasn't that a bit convenient? And then it still works, so that's good. You know, left it filled with gas. That was helpful. And I don't know. It just was like, that was just, you know, I don't care that Lois knew where he was because, let's face it, he's Superman. I'm sure someone would have noticed that he'd ended up in the bottom of a subway and that could have pointed her in the right direction. I can get there on that one. I just couldn't get there on why there was a convenient ship left lying around full of gas with the same tech from 16,000 years ago. And, oh, guess what? We just happened to find it in the 33rd year of Superman being on Earth. That was mighty convenient after 16,000 years. We didn't, you know, unearth it in Roman times. That would have been a bit of a shame. Bugger. You know?
Can I point out sort of a standard, like you were saying about the building falling? Matt was saying about the depth cues of the ship descending into the city. I think District 9 pretty much set the bar for that. For the best realistic compositing and depth cueing of a ship hanging out in the, you know, lower atmosphere of a city. And I think...
Oh, I totally agree. It was spectacularly good. And FYI, I just so want to see Elysium. It's not funny.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really waiting for that one.
Yeah. I've actually spoken to some of the guys on that officially. And, yeah, awesome. So, okay, so notwithstanding my huge plot problem, I do think the film was really, really good. It's obviously going to have a sequel. In fact, they commissioned it before they even finished the first one. And I personally believe it's going to end up being that it's the basis of the sequel. Will have Superman go bad, Batman will come back from retirement at the very end, and that'll be the start of the Justice League. And I think that's all really good. I think that's a good
future. Or Dark Knight Returns at some point.
That's what I'm saying, though. Dark Knight will come back at the end of Superman going bad and fix it, and everyone will go gasp, it's so brilliant. Because that's what the comics do. And people have told me that, and I'm like, that totally makes sense.
The Frank Miller, that's what I'm saying, the Dark Knight Returns, the Frank Miller is like, it's like the Bible of comic books. Right?
And that's,
I mean, it's like the story.
Yeah, totally. And I don't need it. I understand that origin stories are somewhat difficult because you know where they're going, but I think this was a really good implementation of it. I think all the companies that we've spoken about are great, but I should just give a shout out or mention to some of the others we didn't cover. So those are the big ones, Weta, MPC, and DNEG. Look FX did the bus crash flashback, and PLF, which is still, I reckon, one of the greatest names of a company ever, did all the previews. And then Blur and Teamworks did some other stuff I noticed in the credits when they went by. I think I've got those in the right kind of order. I noticed that that the big houses got big credits, and then there was sort of almost a one-liner of other companies helped us kind of thing. But apologies to any artists that we missed out giving any acknowledgements to.
And who was it that did the big twister?
Terrific question. Let me just see if I've got that in the notes.
Was it Scanline? I have some...
It is. It was Scanline. You're right. Scanline did two things, actually, in the... they did that and something else. What was the other one? They did the tornado and the oil rig. Thank you. The oil rig.
Oh, right.
The
oil rig.
Yeah, the oil rig was good.
I thought the fluid sims around the oil rig and stuff were suitably spectacular, given that Scanline owns that for just... They're the go-to place for big water sims right now.
But also when he bursts in to save the dudes and he's on fire without his shirt on, I thought that was really well done. I didn't question it. Like, I wasn't like, oh, look at that, you know.
It felt a little...
fire.
Yeah, it felt a little hazy, effects-y from a helicopter shot looking down at the deck when he was holding off the falling pylons kind of stuff. And
yeah, I just meant the close-up when he opens the
door.
No,
with you. I'm with you. Yeah, I totally agree. I just thought that the fire didn't look quite as good as that in some of the shots.
Right.
Where it sort of had almost too much motion blur. It would just, or somebody had wound up the heat haze too much, and it was just all a bit kind of, there was a Wolverine sequence like that as well, I remember, where it was just, it was almost like you couldn't get the fine detailed, like flames are quite precise. Like you can sit and watch a fire, assuming you're not too close to it, you know, and you can really make out what's going on. It doesn't tend to get that disrupted unless it's obscured by smoke. You don't, in my experience, get a lot of just red kind of wobbly stuff. And
all right, so I have to ask a question. This is kind of ridiculous, but I'm just so curious. So the fire doesn't burn Superman's hair, right? Because he's the Man of Steel. How does he shave?
You just walked right into that one. Don't you know, John Montgomery posted a rather disappointed product tie-in. There's an entire Gillette campaign built around how does Superman shave. You just walked into the huge product placement. There was a whole website on, you know, how does he shave, and you got to see extra bits of the film before it came out. And
because ideally he'd have a beard down to his feet.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff like that, right?
Like, I think he uses his heat vision in a mirror to bounce it off and burn it off.
Yeah, how does he cut his toenails?
Now we're talking. All right.
Yeah, now we're actually sounding like three guys from Big Bang Theory sitting in the cafeteria.
And that would be different from every other show because...
there's one of my all-time, as you know, I'm a big fan of Red Dwarf. One of my all-time favorite things that I sometimes think of when we're having these discussions. There's a scene in Red Dwarf where they're sitting around talking about, would you date Betty or Wilma? And their cat and Lister are sitting there talking about this, and they're just going on and on about it until finally one of them goes, I don't know what we're doing. We're just pathetic. We're useless. This is ridiculous. It's the stupidest conversation ever. And the other one goes, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's no way she's ever leaving Fred.
And that's awesome.
I just feel like we got to get there a little bit sometimes, but hey, well, I'm sure we're amongst friends, dear listeners.
A friend of mine pointed out, which I did not see, that on the satellite they destroy when they're fighting, it says Wayne Industries.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there are quite a few of those. And also, apparently, when he's being bullied but squeezes the post, his father walks over, that is the company that's in the Smallville TV show that his father is visiting.
I never saw that show.
There's tons of that kind of stuff, like references to, and apparently Easter eggs galore. And I like that they do that. Like, it's a lot of fun to.
Yeah.
I'm certainly going to go back and see it a second time with people. It's only actually opened here. I got an early press screening, so I'll take.
It's only been here for a week, but.
Some enthusiastic teenagers, I'm sure, will love to have Dad take them out and waste. Yeah.
Can I point out something about the score that I thought was interesting? Of course, it's Hans Zimmer, who's the master of all action movie scores. And I mean that lovingly. I'm not being facetious. That he recorded the drums and the music in general is recorded in some crazy new surround sound format that I guess you can – it works on like iOS or Android devices for some reason and not regular stereos. Maybe it's just a computer thing. But he got – for the percussion, it's 10 drummers. You can find pictures of it online. It's like 10 full drum kits set up around in a circle or a square kind of. But it's like, for the music nerds, it's like Danny Carey, the drummer from Tool, Matt Chamberlain, Vinnie Colaiuta, Sheila E., J.D. Robinson or J.R. Robinson. Who is the other one? Jim Keltner. Like, it's like dudes, like the dudes, right? Jason Bonham. All the dudes playing drums in this weird, crazy drum circle. And then a lot of the string orchestra sections are actually 8 of like the world's top pedal steel guitar players.
Wow.
Now it makes me want to listen to, when I read that, it makes me want to listen to the soundtrack because it didn't sound like that per se, but now I want to listen to it and see if I can find that in the score because I thought the score was really good actually.
Yeah, how do we feel about not having the distinctive, was it Williams?
I'm fine with it.
I'm fine with it too. Like, I mean, I love that John Williams score. Like, it's so much fun to just listen to.
It's probably one of the greatest sort of theme, character theme things ever, right? Yeah.
It's just so bombastic and huge and like real kind of triumphant sounding. But I thought the Zimmer score was really cool. It played great in the trailers. And then in context of the film, I don't know. I thought it worked really nicely. Like it added rather than took away, but it didn't add to me, it didn't add on the same level as the Williams score, because the Williams score really was like kind of followed that sort of Star Wars or Bernard Herrmann kind of vibe. Like, and this one was much more kind of subdued and more minimal, but it did strike a lot of the right notes. And in the real sort of the human element, you know, the real human scenes where it's kind of him interacting with his father or his mother, which were the ones that I felt like the film could have used a few more of those moments, but the score worked really great in those because I think it really did a lot to evoke the kind of emotion that they were going for to kind of try to help build more character.
I want to finish out this. Sorry, is there any other points you wanted to make on the film? Because I wanted to change the subject slightly and have a rat hole at the end here. I mean, I think we're in pretty much agreement that, you know, clearly this was a good film to see if people haven't seen it. I wanted to just get a quick rundown. We're at the beginning of this mega run of summer blockbusters, and I just thought, given we can't do this with everyone that's listening, though I wish I could, I thought I'd just get your take on films, because I think earlier, Jason, you said that you're really looking forward to this from the trailer. Well, most of the trailers are out now. So can I get you to give us, I was going to say thumbs up or thumbs down, but that sounds like you've seen them. So let's call it lean or keen. Are you keen or not so much to see, if I give you sort of 4 or 5 films and just give me your kind of one word, yay or nay? Because that'll factor into when we come to do them, if we do them on the show, whether or not at this stage we actually were looking forward to them or not. I know that there are some films I've really changed my opinion about. So Lone Ranger.
Normally, no, but I love Gore Verbinski, so yes, I will see it.
Matt?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I'm not, I could take it or leave it. I don't, that one doesn't really, get me going, but you know, I might check it out if my son wants to go see it.
World War Z?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to see it for no other reason than I've read so much about all the production issues. I read the book as well, and I love the book. And the production issues, you know, the stories around it are so interesting. But what has been blowing me away is there's all these advanced reviews from people who've seen it who actually say it's pretty damn good. So that's intriguing to me.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited for it.
Wolverine?
I mean, I'll see it, but the fact that they didn't get Duncan Jones to do it, kind of, I was like, whatever. Or Aronofsky, who initially was going to do it and backed off. It was just kind of like, meh.
White House Down?
No.
Yeah, I don't think that's one. I'll wait for that one to come out on video.
So it's Olympus Has Fallen, but it's a comedy about the White House getting destroyed. I don't quite get it, but
it's not a comedy. It's a buddy movie.
Okay. I'm not sure there would be that much humor going on between if the White House got blown up, and I'm not even that patriotic, but for those people who would be defending it, literally, you know, as soldiers, I don't think they would be that happy about it.
Pac Rim?
Yes, 100 gajillion percent.
Yeah, and I'm totally up for seeing that one. I don't know. I love, I think it was Jeff Huser, right, who he made the funniest comment on Twitter after that trailer first came out, and he's like, I don't know what it is. I feel like somebody just threw a bunch of Skittles in my eyes or something like that, and I could kind of get that vibe just because it's so punchy and juicy, like all the colors in that trailer. It almost looks like the Speed Racer kind of thing going on or something, but I am excited to see it. Yeah, giant robots and giant monsters.
Giant robots punching giant sea monsters. I don't really care. They could be selling fucking baloney. Yeah, they could literally be a 2-hour baloney commercial, and I would not care.
Elysium?
Gajillion percent. I wanted to see it before when I knew nothing about it, and now the fact that I've seen the trailer, absolutely.
Matt?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that looks like... That looks like the big movie of the sleeper hit of the late summer. I mean,
for sure.
If it's anything like that trailer in terms of story and everything coming together, I mean, it just looks top shelf. I mean, and the Elysium station, like the fact that somebody finally took all of those amazing, you know, visualizations from so many different artists over the years, you know, from the 50s up through, you know, the 60s, the 70s, and there's a great Sid Mead one, and all these great sort of ring worlds, and built one and put it into a film and made it look so dang cool. Like, I mean, just for that alone, I'm dying to see it.
Well, you had me at Jodie Foster, but yeah, I totally agree. I think it's going to be just sensationally awesome. And of course, finally, finishing out the summer, the big one, Smurfs 2.
I did not see the first one.
Really? Yeah. Well, don't see the second one. It'd spoil it for you.
Yeah,
that's true.
They're blue and they're here. Okay, so thanks so much for that, guys. Jason, where can people touch base, follow you on Twitter, etc.?
The Twitter's Jason Diamond, one word, or my website with my brother, thediamondbros.com.
And are you going to be using the 15 seconds of fame in Twitter as a conduit for some kind of narrative?
What's
social
that?
Media? Well, that you can now, you know, do
Instagram.
Instagram with Instagram with 15 seconds of
as
video.
Opposed to the old fashioned 6 seconds of Vine.
Yeah.
No, although a friend of mine is working on, I don't know if I can specifically say, I don't know if it came out yet. Maybe it did. Anyway, she's working for an ad agency as a creative director, and she did a Vine for a mobile phone, but they did a stop motion Vine where they literally touched the screen once, touched the screen, you know, for each, cause you know, you touch the screen, it starts and stops. And it blew my mind how complicated they did their animation. Just that way, like literally, like quote unquote in camera, because there's you can't edit it.
That's the thing I was going to say. Like, if you could edit them, they'd be 15-second commercials constantly.
Right.
And if somebody hacks a way of getting a video in that's already edited elsewhere, that's what that'll be, 15 seconds of ads. But otherwise, I think we're going to be seeing amazing stunts to see what you can do with 15 seconds on and off. Well, I think you can stop start it, right? Yeah, in the middle.
Yeah. A friend of mine said, so Vine starts at 6 seconds. Instagram comes out with 15 seconds. Vine, to combat that, is going to go to 30 seconds, and they're going to keep leapfrogging each other until they get to a minute, YouTube. 2 minute YouTube, and then some genius will come along and say, look, we can do this 6 second thing, and it'll just be this horrendous cycle of quote-unquote innovation.
Matt, what about you? What about connecting up with you?
Oh, you can always find me at mattwallen.com, Matt Wallen. If anybody was interested in, I gave a TEDx talk this last February or March, I guess it was, and it's finally up and cut on video, and you can actually see it on, if you want, we have a website for the tool that we've been developing. It's mappingcolor.com, and it's color spelled in the sort of improper English American way without the U, so C-O-L-O-R, mappingcolor.com.
Brilliant. Of course, I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter, and I'm about to hit somebody is going to join in the next few minutes and turn me over to 10,000 followers. So thank you, everybody that's been doing that. I also want to thank some people like Kurt and some others that posted on Twitter saying that I was completely wrong. And I'm being sarcastic. I actually really like it when people have opposing points of view. So if you have an opposing point of view of what we've said, don't just yell at the at the iPod player in your car as you're listening to this, you know, send us a line. And we'd love to hear different points of view. They're all good. We don't need everyone just to agree with us. Absolutely enjoy the discussion. So if you're one of the people that posted on Twitter and said that it was an awful, awful, gross, what was it? Glossy crap with no content film. That's fine. I'm really genuinely welcome the debate. I just happen to like it. And I want to thank the guys that produce the show and put the show together each week. It's awfully, remiss of me not to thank them every week. Todd in particular puts the show notes. Ian does a lot of coordination stuff, and the guys that edited out of Chicago. We really appreciate all of the support. Until next time, when we'll be hitting obviously some of these films that we just rated, maybe not quite all of them, but we'll try. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. Thanks so much for being with us. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com.